Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. According to the Georgia Department of Family and Children's Services statistics, in 2012, the agency reported 152 deaths of children that they had been in contact with. This was an alarming average of almost 3 children per week. Then the following year, DFCS came under scrutiny once again when a young girl was found dead, and their records indicated a long history of abuse claims. It was approximately 3:43 a.m. on the 2nd of November 2013 when Gwinnett County Police received a 911 call from Eman Moss. He told the dispatcher that he wanted to end his life and informed them that there was a dead body with him at his apartment. He claimed that his 10-year-old daughter had drank some kind of chemical and died. When officers arrived at the apartment at 1131 Veranda Chase Drive near Lawrenceville, they discovered Eman standing in a breezeway. He pointed towards a trash can in the recreation area where the officers discovered the badly burned body of 10-year-old Imani Moss. Upon first sight of Imani's body, it was evident that she had been systematically starved over a period of time. According to police detective Colin Flynn, the victim appeared extremely emaciated and skinny. It was theorized that Imani had died around 3 days earlier, and her body was subsequently placed into the trash can and then set on fire in an attempt to conceal any evidence. Eman, Imani's father, and Imani's stepmother, Tiffany Cross, were both arrested and charged with felony murder, cruelty to children in the first degree, and concealing a body. They both denied any involvement in Imani's death, and Eman stuck to the story that Imani had drank some kind of chemical and died. He claimed that when he found Imani dead, he panicked and put her body in the trash can outside of the apartment and set it on fire. According to the police report, 9 days ago, Eman came home and Imani was in the bathtub and shaking very badly. Eman came home on the 30th of October and found Imani deceased. Tiffany told him to get rid of the body. Eman stated that they went and brought a trash can and took the body to another location away from the apartment and tried to burn the body for 20 minutes, but the body wouldn't burn. Later, Eman suggested that Tiffany had poisoned Imani, telling the detective that Tiffany and Imani had a rocky relationship. When presented with the evidence, however, Eman finally confessed that they had starved Imani. Shortly after their arrests, a history of abuse claims came to the surface, and evidently, the warning signs had been piling up for far too long. In 2004, Eman was arrested in Gwinnett for 2 counts of cruelty to children in the second degree and battery. Police and school administrators had reported abuse to the state at least 2 times in the past 3 years. On the 9th of March 2010, Imani had told a school nurse that she was terrified of going home because she had received a bad report card. She confided in the nurse that she was afraid that her parents would hurt her because of her bad grades. While speaking to Imani, the nurse noticed that Imani was riddled with bruises. She reported her fears that Imani was being abused at home to police. Upon receiving the report, police took Imani and Tiffany, who was a teacher at the time, to police headquarters for an interview. They too noticed that Imani had severe bruises and welts all across her body. According to the police report, Imani had several marks that appeared to be welts on her back and had several marks on her chest that were scabbed over. She also had a bruise on her right thigh that appeared to have been made in the last couple of days. Tiffany confessed to police that she had hit Imani with the belt three times, and she was subsequently arrested on child cruelty charges. She signed a plea deal in exchange for 5 years probation. However, DFCS dismissed the case after Tiffany and Eman took parenting classes. At the sentencing phase, her attorney, Eric Carter, said they have met with DFCS. DFCS has dismissed the case against them. Her and her husband have both taken parenting classes and everything that DFCS has requested. Then on the 2nd of July 2012, Imani herself reached out for help. She had tried running away from home. However, at 5:35 p.m. that evening, she was found in the leasing office of her family's apartment complex.
She said that it was her intention to run away. She did. She said about a week prior, her stepmother tied her to a chair utilizing belts and put her under a cold shower. I did ask her to see her arms. As she started to lift them to show me, she became hesitant and then put them back down by her side. Her statement to me was that the belts did not hurt.
She told a Gwinnett County officer that she did not like living at home with her father and her stepmother. She confided in the officer that she had been tied to a chair with two belts and placed under a cold shower by Tiffany. Tiffany came to pick Imani up and completely denied the allegations. She claimed that Imani had ran away from home just the other night before because she had wanted to stay overnight at a friend's house and was told no. She told the officer that Imani was simply competing for her father's attention and was jealous of her younger brother and her soon-to-be-born younger sister. Despite the fact that Imani was often riddled with bruises and it was evident that she was being abused at home, neither Tiffany or Eman were charged. We could not prove that it occurred. However, that report was forwarded to DFACS for investigation or follow-up, said Captain Ed Ritter with the Gwinnett County Police Department. Then on the 25th of July 2012, Imani ran away from home once again. She stayed out until the following morning when she was arrested as a runaway juvenile, sent back home and given a curfew violation. According to Officer Ed Ritter, they had charged her as a juvenile runaway so that they could hopefully get her into court. We forwarded that case to DFCS, he said. Following the abuse report, Imani was removed from school. More than 10 years before the body of Imani was discovered, emaciated and burned, Eman and Danita Leakes had begun dating. Danita was the mother of Imani. While the relationship started out all roses and butterflies, things took a drastic turn for the worst when Danita discovered that she was pregnant with Imani. She recollected, "When we started dating, he wasn't like this. He was a very nice guy." While a pregnancy announcement should be cause for celebration, Eman began starting arguments and fighting with Danita constantly. By 2004, Danita had filed paperwork to seek custody of Imani, who was barely 1 year old. The custody battle was marred by accusations of physical violence. In a letter to the magistrate judge overseeing the case, she wrote, "Iman is a very violent person and demonstrates physical violence when he can't get his way with me, in that he will argue, rant, rave, and cause physical harm to my person when enraged." In April of 2004, Eman was arrested and charged with battery and second-degree cruelty to children, which was the result of a physical attack against Danita while Imani watched. According to Danita, following the separation, Eman and his mother would keep Imani for long periods of time and refuse to let her see her. In fact, when Danita discovered that Imani had been murdered, she hadn't seen her daughter in around 6 years. "The last time I let him see her, he just kept her," she said. Danita had signed away her parental rights on the 11th of April, 2005. Speaking with the Gwinnett Daily Post, Danita said, "I thought they loved her. I didn't know they were going to do this to my baby. I wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt." Following the arrest of Eman and Tiffany, their other children, both of whom were toddlers under the age of 3, were taken into DFCS custody. There was no evidence to indicate that either toddler had been abused in any way. A According to Imani's grandmother, Robin Moss, who was Iman's mother, she had suspected that Imani was being abused at home, but she said that she apparently couldn't persuade authorities to grant her custody. According to Robin, Imani had been a normal weight for her age around a year earlier. However, by May of 2013, she had noticed that she had lost a significant amount of weight and her long hair had been sloppily chopped off. She looked awful, Robin recollected. Concerned about her granddaughter's appearance, Robin began questioning Tiffany. According to Robin, Tiffany replied, "When you act up, you should look ugly." It was following this disturbing comment that Robin had called DFCS, but as far as she was aware, they hadn't bothered to investigate her claims. According to Robin, the sight of Imani had really traumatized her. After Iman and Danita had broken up, Iman and Imani had moved in with Robin and she had helped raise Imani for 5 years. Then in 2009, Iman and Imani moved out and moved in with Tiffany. Robin couldn't quite understand what had gone so wrong. After Tiffany had been charged with child cruelty, Imani was removed from Tiffany and Iman's care and had gone to live with Robin for a period of time. During this period, Imani's school counsellor told DFCS agency staff that she was doing much better in school.
I feel bad because it's like no matter how much I fought, it was just like no one there to help me. No one. No matter how many times I went down there, and I took my sisters, I took a lot of people down there to fight because they wanted me to give her back, and I didn't want to give her back after the 6 months. And then they put her back in that home. And I knew that when they put her back in that home, that was it. Because when I got her, she was bruised up very, very badly. You know, in her chest, like fingernail marks in her chest, bruises all over her whole body. And I would sit there and rub her down and try to heal her up and get her emotions back up because she was afraid of everything. She got to the point where if she dropped the glass, she'd start running and screaming and going in a corner. I'm like, it's just a glass, baby. Grandma, I'm going to sweep it up and clean it up, but put your shoes on in case I didn't get everything up, you know. But that's just a glass. I can go back to Walmart or wherever I got and get another glass. That's not important. She thought it was a punishment for everything, but she knew it wasn't done with me. I wasn't like that. But from being in that house, she came timid. She wasn't herself. She was afraid.
However, Imani was returned home after Tiffany and Iman took parenting classes. Robin told the media that while Imani was with her, Iman had seemed like a decent father. However, over the past 3 years, things had taken a turn for the worse. Robin said that she was allowed to see Imani less and less, most likely in a bid to conceal the abuse that was being inflicted on Imani. She said, "When I see him now, look at him, he's not him. I don't see him. I see evilness." After Iman and Tiffany were arrested, Robin visited her son in the Gwinnett County Jail. From behind a sheet of glass, Iman told Robin, "Mommy, I'm sorry. This is not what I wanted, and I know right now you just want to kill me. I know right now I have broken your heart." According to Robin, she stared deep into her son's eyes, searching desperately for something familiar, to try and see the son she once knew. According to Robin, however, all she saw was evil. As details of Imani's tragic life came to the surface, many were left questioning how this happened. There was enough evidence that Imani was being abused at home. She herself had even begged for help. Seemingly, officials paid no attention to the warning signs that predated Imani's brutal death. Many looked towards DFCS for answers. As it would soon be revealed, Imani and her family had been the focus of state family and child investigations for Imani's entire life. There had been more reports than what was first initially reported in the media. In fact, there were 6 previous contacts or complaints with DFCS, the most recent of which happened just 2 months before Imani was murdered. Division Director Sharon Hill said, "I am committed to ensuring whatever action that needs to be taken is taken. whether that's corrective action or personal changes. According to the case files, two of the cases involving the Moss family were screened but allegedly lacked enough facts for DFCS to act. One case was closed when Amani didn't make any complaints during an interview. Two more cases were found unsubstantiated. In 2003 and 2005, two reports indicated inadequate food, clothing, and shelter for Amani, as well as evidence of emotional neglect. However, this was found unsubstantiated by DFCS. In late 2008 and early 2009, when Amani was just 5 years old, DFCS reported concerns that Amani was being sexually abused. According to the reports, Amani had been acting strange and crying more than usual when she got frustrated. When questioned if somebody was being inappropriate with her by a DFCS worker, Amani replied, "If I tell anyone, then I would not be able to see you anymore." DFCS met with Amani alone at school and discussed her home life, but seemingly no concerns were noted and the case was closed. In a 2010 report, Amani told the teacher that she was spanked with a belt for not finishing her schoolwork, and said that this was how she was normally disciplined if she did not finish her schoolwork or get good grades. In May of 2012, a DFCS worker said that Amani told the teacher that she had been hit on the back of the head with a belt because she was eating her breakfast too slowly. She said that she had been hit 3 times, once in each of 3 rooms in the house. DFCS found that the injury was insignificant and screened the report out as no maltreatment alleged and determined that the injuries were corporal punishment. Later in 2012, a teacher reported that Amani had welts from being beaten with a belt. DFCS didn't bother to investigate. They didn't send a caseworker to interview Amani, examine her injuries, or question Iman or Tiffany. In the most recent contact DFCS had with Amani, an anonymous reporter was suspicious that Amani was being abused and neglected at home. They described that Amani appeared to be extremely thin and was distant and appeared afraid to interact. According to the DFCS report, the case was quickly screened out because DFCS had no current address. There was no evidence that DFCS had even attempted to locate Amani. None of these reports had ever acknowledged that Tiffany was on probation for abusing Amani in 2010. One would think and hope that this alone would have been motivation to monitor the family more closely and investigate the claims even further, not just screen them out. It appeared as though each report was viewed in isolation and they did not respond with a sense of urgency. In the run-up to Amani's death, there had been growing concerns that many Georgia children with DFCS histories were falling through the cracks. According to state reports, 152 children in Georgia with a history with DFCS died in 2012 alone. Out of those cases, 18 had been labelled homicides, 42 were still pending or undetermined, 86 were natural or accidental, and 6 were suicides. Imani wasn't the only recent case either. Back in October, 12-year-old Eric Forbes, who was well known to DFCS, was killed by his abusive father. Teachers at Eric's school had reported suspected abuse at least 3 times to DFCS. According to DFCS, however, there was insufficient evidence to support a filing of abuse or neglect. Months later, Eric was beaten to death by his father. When Amani's case hit the media, it brought renewed scrutiny to Georgia's DFCS. The system had failed many children in Georgia, and yet the state continued to cut funding in an area where funding was critically needed. The cuts had left the child welfare system under-resourced and under-reported. The fact that a little girl would run away from home 2 times in the same month should have been warning enough that something wasn't right, said Melissa Carter, director of the Barton Child Law and Policy Centre at Emory University School of Law. Some, however, defended the agency, stating that they were often placed in situations that were next to impossible. According to psychologist Andy Gothard, who had performed over 5,000 evaluations of foster children and parents for DFCS. They were damned if they do and damned if they don't. He said, DFCS are categorized as either baby killers if they do not remove children from their homes when the worst case scenario occurs, or they are called baby snatchers or kidnappers if they are overzealous. He admitted that the agency was far from perfect, but said that DFCS was underfunded and understaffed. It was subsequently announced that the agency would be conducting an internal review to examine the handling of the case. DFCS would ultimately attribute oversights to 6 workers. They fired 2 of them and punished the other 4. Days later, the couple appeared in court while a Gwinnett County judge was presented evidence against them. According to police detective Colin Flynn, Iman had first of all denied the murder before finally confessing, I'm guilty, I killed my baby. However, he placed most of the blame onto Tiffany. He claimed that on the 24th of October, he came home from work to discover Imani seizing up in the bathtub. While he was at work, Tiffany was supposed to look after the children. According to Iman, she offered no explanation other than it was an accident. Neither Iman or Tiffany gave Imani food, water, or medicine. They didn't call 911 or try to get help. Imani lay in the bathtub until she died 7 days later. According to Iman, following Imani's death, Tiffany persuaded him to get rid of her body so that their family could stay together. They purchased a trash can and drove around Gwinnett County looking for a place to dump her body. They even drove out to Stone Mountain Park. Ultimately, they decided to burn Imani outside of their own apartment. She was duct-taped into a ball, wrist to ankles, and then stuffed into the trash can, followed by charcoal and lighter fluid. He thought the body would turn to ashes, but it didn't, said Police Detective Flynn. During the hearing, it was revealed that Imani weighed only 32 pounds when she died. It was evident that she had been systematically starved. This wasn't something that happened over the course of just 1 week. According to neighbours, they didn't even know that Imani existed, yet they saw her siblings quite often playing outside. According to one neighbour, he had heard an agonising scream coming from the apartment one night. Imani's bedroom was practically bare. There was nothing but an old mattress and a few items of clothing. There was nothing but an overpowering smell of urine to keep Imani company as she slowly starved to death. Iman had called 911 against Tiffany's objections. With police on the way to their apartment, Tiffany fled from the apartment with the couple's 2 children. She dropped them off at her mother's home, changed her clothing, and told her mother that she did not want to go to jail, but did not divulge any more information. After Iman was arrested at the apartment, Tiffany handed herself in at the Roswell Police Department. The case was bound over to Gwinnett Superior Court. It still wasn't known if the state would be seeking the death penalty against the couple, but according to District Attorney Danny Porter, in 30 years of doing this is probably the worst case I've seen. I think once we learn more about the mechanisms of starvation and the suffering that's involved, it may qualify as torture. In DA Porter's entire career, he had only asked for the death penalty 10 times. On the 12th of November, a vigil was held in memory of Imani. It was the first time that practically everybody got an insight into who Imani was as a child, and not just a headline. She had been forced to live a life of secrecy, so much so that her neighbours didn't even know she existed. Hundreds of people crowded into Progression Church in Atlanta, where Pastor Calvert Robertson said, "We come to celebrate her beautiful spirit. We come to mourn her passing, and we have come to make sure that her life, although short, will be remembered. We also came to realize the problem. The children should not needlessly die." Photographs of Imani were displayed on a screen behind a podium where Robin spoke about Imani, who she had nicknamed Angel Face. Imani was described as an angel whose presence would light up a room. She was kind, respectful, and always wore ribbons and beads in her hair. That was at least until Tiffany chopped all of her hair off. She enjoyed playing guitar, singing, writing songs, and at one point in her short life, she took ballet. Imani also loved God. She would preach to her stuffed animals and Barbies. According to Trish Lard, who was the mother of one of Imani's classmates, Imani was the life of the party at school, despite what she was going through at home. Her uncle, Doran MacArthur, tearfully told the mourners, "Honestly, we shouldn't even be here right now. I feel like I should have done more. I just want to say I'm sorry." Minister Anthony Freeman of Fairfield Baptist Church said, "I think the one thing that runs through the fabric of what everyone is saying here is that this has to start change. Change has to begin now. I want people to be aware that we're trying to get bills passed to keep this thing from happening to any other children." The mourners prayed for both Imani and for her accused killers, while Pastor Antonio Thomas said, "Imani is in the safe arms of the Lord. No one will bother her anymore. No more suffering, no more crying." Following the vigil, Robin said, "We don't want any other children to be hurt ever. Ever. My granddaughter paid a price. She cried. She had a silent cry, but I heard her out loud. And I think more people need to start getting involved. I think people need to start knocking on doors. It's time. It's actually past time. This shouldn't have ever happened." Just the following day, Governor Nathan Deal announced that he was planning on spending $27 million to hire over 500 new DFCS caseworkers and supervisors over the next 3 years. Speaking to Channel 2, he said, "Our goal is to try to make sure that as nearly as humanly possible, these kinds of cases will not be repeated." He additionally said that DFCS would be implementing a more intensive training course for all caseworkers and supervisors. In December, it was announced that Iman and Tiffany were fighting for custody of their two other children. They were in court to oppose Robin from taking their children to live with her. In court, attorneys for Iman and Tiffany argued that Robin was not a suitable guardian for their children and stated that she did not have any income, reliable transportation, or a home big enough. They questioned Robin about the children's favourite colour, to which Robin replied, "I don't know. That's why I said I want to get to know them." Robin had told the judge that ultimately she had hoped to adopt both children. The following month, District Attorney Danny Porter announced that he would be seeking the death penalty against Iman and Tiffany because the facts of the case constitute torture of Imani. Then in March, Senate Bill 350 was passed, which allowed approved faith and community-based organizations to be contracted for services such as adoption, foster care, and case management. In short, that meant that some child welfare services in Georgia were being privatized. The bill led to an outrage among a number of citizens. There was an article in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution titled "Child Welfare Privatization Not Thought Through," which read in part, "For years, Georgia has failed to do right on behalf of its abused and neglected children. We have spent too little and cared too little. We have handed off responsibility for life and death decisions about those children to underpaid, overworked state workers, and when they have failed, resulting in tragic deaths, we have scapegoated those same employees for a failure that we, as Georgia citizens, had made inevitable." During the debate over the bill, Senator Renee Unterman said that Senate Bill 350 would have saved Imani. However, in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution article, it read, "It would not. The state of Georgia failed Imani by leaving her in the care of parents whom it had good cause to know were abusive. It failed her because to save money, we slashed personnel paid to investigate and decide her case, and too many thousands like it." Under Senate Bill 350, the responsibility to remove endangered children from abusive homes would still remain with state employees. It was just once they were put into state care that the subsequent decisions of their fate would be made by private contractors. There had been a similar bill in Nebraska, which had been such a failure that it was abandoned less than 3 years later. Towards the end of April, a judge ruled that Imani's siblings would be staying in state custody, at least for the time being. According to Judge Robert Waller, neither Robin or their other grandmother were fit to care for two toddlers. During the hearing, Judge Waller blasted the other grandmother, Pearlie Basher, for not speaking up and saving Imani. In the last few months of Imani's life, she and her family had lived with Pearlie for a long period of time. According to Pearlie, she never noticed anything wrong with Imani, despite the fact that she was severely malnourished and constantly riddled with bruises and wounds. The judge wrote, "It is unfathomable to the court that Mrs. B could not have known that Imani M was being abused and mistreated at some point between 2010 and October 2013. At best, Mrs. B turned a blind eye to the suffering and ultimately to the death of a child who had been living in her home on and off for over 3 years. She cannot be depended upon to protect the children living in her home." Outside of court, Robin said that she too believed that Pearlie knew exactly what was going on, and she chose to look the other way. In June, Iman and Tiffany appeared in court once again, along with Robin and Pearlie, to once again fight it out for custody. In court, Pearlie asked the judge to reconsider, stating, "It was said I turned a blind eye. I disagree with that. I know I would be a good placement for the children, and that if it's not with me, at least place them with the family and not an outside adoption." Robin told the judge that she accepted his decision and said that she did not want the children going to live with Pearlie. The judge refused to reverse his decision and ordered that the siblings remain in foster care for the time being. Meanwhile, DFCS ordered mandatory overtime for agency investigators in a bid to reduce the state's backlog in child protection investigations. Under agency policy, investigations into child safety should be completed within 45 days. However, at the time, DFCS had more than 3,000 overdue Child Protective Services investigations, and that figure was 48% of their current caseload. That meant that almost half of their cases were overdue. According to DFCS Interim Director Bobby Cagle, "Each of these overdue cases represents a potential risk for vulnerable children in our state, and this requires swift action on our part. We must make sure that these children are in a safe situation as soon as possible." In early July, Iman and Tiffany both pleaded not guilty to the murder of Imani. Then in January of 2015, Governor Nathan Deal released a final report of recommendations for his Child Welfare Reform Council, which included creating a child abuse registry, adding pay incentives for DFCS caseworkers, and developing a panic button which would increase safety for workers in the field. In a news conference, he said that protecting Georgia's children was the ultimate goal. Then around 5 months later, it was announced that Iman had pleaded guilty to the death of Imani in a bid to avoid the death penalty. He had reached a plea deal, but was still looking at a life sentence without the possibility of parole. From the very beginning, he's admitted his involvement and he's expressed extreme remorse, said District Attorney Danny Porter. According to the District Attorney, it was expected that there would be no plea offer for Tiffany. "We think the evidence is pretty clear that she was the primary force behind this," he said. It was additionally announced that Iman had agreed to testify against Tiffany. On the 14th of November, Iman was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. During the sentencing hearing, Iman read out a letter which he wrote for his deceased daughter. It read in part, "Dear Imani Moss, my angel face, my beautiful princess, my firstborn, my baby girl, my diamond in the sky. Daddy is so, so sorry for my actions. Daddy's actions caused me to lose a rare gemstone that was you. I wanted you to know that Daddy made a terrible mistake and he is very sorry from the bottom of my heart. The thing that brings me so much pain in my heart is I can't bring you back. I cannot kiss you. I cannot hold you. I cannot tell you I miss you. I cannot tell you I love you. And the worst of all, I can't see you become a beautiful woman because of my bad mistake and my bad decision. So again, I apologize deeply for failing you. I'm sorry, Imani. No, I have owned my mistakes. No, I have owned my faults that led me here. I have accepted my part without blaming anyone but myself. I have accepted the grief, the pain, the suffering that I have caused the whole family. I am so sorry, Mom. I am so sorry, Dad. I'm so sorry, Aunt B. I'm so sorry, Aunt JC. I am so sorry, Uncle Ken. I am so sorry, Ryan. I am so sorry, Brandon. I am so sorry, Aunt Beverly. I am so sorry for everybody that I have not named. I am so sorry, State of Georgia. I am so sorry, Gwinnett County. And I am so sorry, Your Honor. And I hope everyone can find it in their hearts to forgive me. The letter, of course, was a slap in the face to Imani. In February of 2016, it was announced that Georgia's child abuse workers would no longer be using information gathered over telephone calls to determine maltreatment allegations, and that no case would be assigned a less serious, lower priority status until a caseworker has had direct contact with the child in question. This new approach, which would be implemented statewide, represented a monumental shift in how DFCS worked. For far too long, caseworkers were able to determine how serious a case was after a simple phone call. If this had have been implemented when Imani was still alive, then it very potentially could have saved her life. Following this update, DFCS acknowledged systematic failures contributed to the death of Imani and several other children under their supervision. In a report, they cited significant gaps in their performance and said that they needed to learn from the deaths to prevent such a thing ever happening again. In June of 2018, it was announced that against the advice of every single person involved in her case, Tiffany would be representing herself at trial, stating that it was God's will. The move was highly unusual, especially in a death penalty case, so much so that the judge decided he would delay her trial until the state's highest court order could review the decision to allow Tiffany to be her own lawyer. Tiffany had not even been preparing for her own defense in a way that one would expect. For example, studying the law, filing motions, reviewing evidence, and so on. Instead, Tiffany said that she was preparing in a more spiritual way. She said that she would be relying on divine guidance from above. She even turned down assistance of lawyers from the State Capital Defender's Office. The following month, Robin filed a lawsuit against DFCS. The suit said that Imani had suffered constant abuse and deprivation and that a proper DFCS investigation could very likely have prevented her death. The lawsuit was seeking unspecified damages for the pain and suffering endured by Imani during her life and the full value of the economic and non-economic value of her life she had lived. In December of 2018, it was announced that Tiffany would be allowed to represent herself. Judge George Hutchinson implored Tiffany to accept legal representation, stating, "They are seeking to have you executed, and I can't be more blunt than to say they are trying to have you killed. That's as serious as it can possibly get, and I think it's best that you have an attorney." Tiffany replied with, "I'm confident in my decision, and I'm standing by it." Judge George Hutchinson subsequently set the trial date for the 8th of April 2019. During the hearing, it was noticed that Tiffany had no court documents, no pen, and no paper. She took no notes and asked no questions. Before adjourning the court, Judge George Hutchinson asked Tiffany if there was anything she needed in her trial preparation coming up, to which she replied, "No." With the trial fast approaching, many wondered whether, with her life on the line, Tiffany would put up a fair fight on her own behalf. Would she be providing an opening statement? Would she produce witnesses? Would she cross-examine the prosecution witnesses? According to Atlanta attorney Jack Martin, it looks like a prolonged suicide. God may be an all-powerful and merciful force in nature, but he's a lousy criminal defense lawyer. During the 3-hour pre-trial hearing, Tiffany gave yes and no answers. The only time she elaborated was when she spoke about her clothing her family had brought her so that she could change out of her jail jumpsuit. The death penalty trial opened on the 24th of April, 2019. During opening statements, District Attorney Danny Porter compared the case to a fairy tale with a terrible ending.
This is a case of a Cinderella story gone horribly wrong. In this case, there won't be any glass slipper. There won't be any handsome prince. The defendant doesn't have to be home by midnight. And there won't be any happy ending. Because this is a case where you only have the evil stepmother. And as a result of that, an 11-year-old child was starved to death at her hand, while her own children remained healthy and happy.
He described how Imani, who would have just celebrated her 16th birthday, was a bright and happy child whose personality, physical health, and life was snuffed out by Tiffany. Tiffany declined to offer an opening statement. Robin was one of the first witnesses to testify. She told the jury that over the course of 9 months, the Moss family had moved around so frequently that she had essentially been shut out from seeing her granddaughter. Finally, on Mother's Day of 2013, Robin got to see Imani.
After you said that you saw her at Tristan's birthday party, when was the next time? Because you said there were two times. When was the next time that you saw your granddaughter, Imani?
It was Mother's Day.
And when you say Mother's Day, was that Mother's Day of 2013?
Yes. No, it was. Yes.
Was it the May before she passed in November?
Yeah.
Yes, okay. Where did you see her on Mother's Day?
I was at my daughter's house, living with my daughter, staying with my daughter for a while. And my son and Tiffany came to the house, and Imani was with them.
When they came, so there were several family members there at your daughter's house?
Yes, us, my daughter, and Iman and his family. So my daughter, her family, and Iman and me.
And tell me, what's your daughter's name?
Sharonice.
So you're at Sharonice's house. How did Imani appear to you then?
She was so thin, so thin. She had this shirt on, and you can see the bones protruding out of her shoulders. And in her arms, she was so skinny, I wasn't used to that.
How was her hair?
Cut off. All of it. It's cut.
You said that you noticed her hair on Mother's Day. And why was it so different to you?
Because Imani had long hair and it shouldn't have been cut.
Did you ask about how her hairstyle came to be like that?
Yes, I did. I said, why is her hair cut off?
And who did you ask that to?
I asked Tiffany that.
And what was the response?
If you act ugly, you should look ugly.
When Pearlie took to the stand, she countered this, stating, Imani was thin, but she was eating. She was not being starved. She was eating. While Tiffany was given the chance to cross-examine all of these witnesses, she didn't. District Attorney Porter told the jury that when Iman came home on the 24th of October to find Imani dead, Tiffany said to him, "We have to hide the body. I can't go to jail. I don't want to lose my other children." He described how Imani's bed was soiled with human waste and that the plan was to report Imani as a runaway. After purchasing the trash can, they decided to burn Imani's body inside it. He said, by the time rigor mortis had set in, her body was stiff, her limbs were stiff, but they bent her and they broke her, and they managed to get her small enough. They took the trash can to Satellite Boulevard, where they set her on fire. However, when they realized that she wasn't going to burn to ash, they extinguished the fire and took her back down to the apartment complex. The next day, Iman drove to work with Imani's body in his truck, and when he got home, he decided that he would call the police. One of Imani's teachers testified during the trial as well. She described how Imani had the most beautiful smile. She was so precious. School was her safe place, so she was always smiling, recalled Lisa Neal, Imani's fourth grade teacher at Beth Seda Elementary School.
Imani's behavior in your classroom, was she ever disrespectful in your classroom?
Never.
Okay. What about her obedience to you? In other words, was she ever defiant or disobedient where you had to take disciplinary action?
No, the only, she was precious. It was a blessing to have her in my classroom. She, the only issue we had was having her homework completed on a regular basis. She had difficulty completing her homework. The only outburst that I ever had was she cried because we had these behavior sheets that we had to write on that just to keep a record, and I was going to write down that she didn't complete her homework, and she cried and cried, and I told her it would be okay.
Those type of sheets, did those go home with the child for their parents to see?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
When you say that the only type of schoolwork that she had trouble was just getting back to school with her homework completed?
Yes.
When we talk about what happened in the classroom and her doing her work in the classroom, was she able to perform her work and her schoolwork during the day just fine?
Yes, she was.
All right. Ms. Neal, at the end of the school year then in May, did Imani Moss actually complete fourth grade with you?
She did.
All right. Mm-hmm. And did she, in fact, do well enough that obviously she moved on to fifth grade?
Yes.
All right. And yes. So was she to be then a fifth grader at the beginning of the August 2013 school year?
She would have, yes.
After Imani left your classroom there, did Imani return to your elementary school to start her fifth grade school year?
No. Her friends asked about her, but no.
And did you at that particular time have any idea why she was not enrolled in school there?
No, I did not.
Did you see Imani Moss any time again after she left your classroom in May of 2013?
I did not.
When the 2012 to 2013 school year concluded, Iman and Tiffany said that they would be removing Imani from the school to homeschool her. Sharonese Moss, Imani's aunt, testified that when she learned of this, she objected, and at one point she even called DFCS to intervene, which they didn't. On the second day of the trial, Iman testified against his wife. He described how he had met Tiffany in Freedom Christian Church, and when he brought Imani along with him, they seemed to get along just fine. However, almost as soon as they were married, in 2009, Tiffany began to abuse Imani. He admitted that after Tiffany pleaded guilty to beating Imani in March of 2010, Imani should have stayed with Robin. He said, "In my pride, I was trying to prove something to my mom, that I can do it, and I said no to her request that Imani live with her."
Tell me what life was like after that at your house.
It was rough.
Was Tiffany allowed to work as a teacher after that?
No.
Did Tiffany ever work after 2010?
No.
What did she do?
Stayed at the house.
Stayed at Pearlie's house?
Yeah. Wherever we lived, she stayed at the house.
Did you feel like her job at that point was to take care of the kids?
Yes.
During the time you were at Pearlie's house, did you ever see any issues with Imani in terms of her weight or?
No.
Did you ever see any problems between Imani and Tiffany while you were at Pearlie's?
Yes.
Tell me about those.
Ever since going back to 2010, ever since then, it was like a love-hate relationship.
Explain to the jury what you mean by a love-hate relationship.
Her and Imani was like, it was always something. They couldn't get along.
Did you ever know of Tiffany from 2010, after 2010, to discipline Imani?
No, not until the incident.
All right. I want to ask you, when I say discipline,
okay,
what discipline a child, what does that mean to you?
At that time, spanking.
But are there other ways to discipline children?
Yes.
Is sending to bed without their supper a way of disciplining a child?
No, that's not.
Is putting them in a corner and putting them in timeout a discipline for a child?
Yes.
So you said that when you said that you said that Tiffany didn't discipline Imani, Are you aware of whether or not she used any of the other things other than a spanking to correct her behavior?
Yes, let me go back. When we had the incident where she spanked Imani in 2010, we had to take a class. I took it called the Fatherhood Program, and I think she had to take anger management, and then we had in-home counseling. Because at the time, I was not aware of the other form of discipline, because, you know, I grew up from the old school. You know, you got a spanking, and that was it.
So you learned about other forms of discipline.
But at the time, I didn't know, but, you know, spanking. And
so after 2010, did you decide that you were going to use the other forms of discipline other than spanking?
Yes.
He went on to describe how the relationship between Tiffany and Imani steadily deteriorated. Tiffany was the one assigned to look after the children because Imam worked long hours and often worked two jobs. He said that while at work, he often got text messages from Tiffany claiming that Imani was misbehaving. He said that Tiffany claimed that Imani had defecated on the walls or in her food, but when he came home, there was never any evidence of this. Imani said that events came to a head on the 24th of October 2013 when he came home to discover Imani apparently seizing in the bathtub. He said, "She was shaking. She was trying to say something, but she wasn't saying much. Her eyes were going from left to right." He said that he had wanted to call 911, but Tiffany had told him not to. He took Imani to bed and said that she never again got out of bed. He said, "It was beyond repair. I didn't take Imani to the doctor. I really can't explain why. I was trying to fix something, but I'm not God. But I was trying to fix something beyond repair." According to Iman, he had tried to feed Imani with a spoon in bed, but it was already too late. On the 28th of October, Imani finally died. Instead of calling 911, Tiffany told him to conceal the body. On the 1st of November, they stuffed her body into the trash can. He said, "It was very difficult to get her in the trash can. There were kind of like cracking sounds. I can't explain it. I don't know what to compare it to." He described how when he came back home from work, he told Tiffany they had to call 911. Tiffany wasn't happy and fled from the home with her two children before later turning herself in. The evidence provided by Iman was damning, and once again, Tiffany declined to cross-examine him. Two crime scene investigators testified that Tiffany's fingerprints were discovered on the trash can. Dr. Michelle Stauffenberg, the pathologist, was also called to the witness stand, while autopsy photographs of Imani were displayed.
The body was inside the trash can with the feet pointing up. The body was wrapped in a trash bag that covered the entire body except for the feet. The feet were sticking out a little bit. There's also a strong odor of charcoal lighter fluid, and part of the body had been burned. The body was removed from the trash can, and it was wrapped in a trash bag, as I said, with the feet exposed. Inside the trash can, left inside, were some partially burnt charcoal briquettes that remained at the bottom of the can. At that point, more photographs were taken of the body, and we could see that there was burning on the outside of the bag. Part of it was melted. The feet and one of the hands were burnt, and so we started to remove the plastic to observe the body inside the bag. Once again, photographing the body, we remove the clothes and get some photographs. In this case, in addition to the clothing, she also had some duct tape wrapped around her in order to keep her legs and arms in a flexed position. And so the duct tape was removed, and all of those items from outside the body were transferred to the police department for further examination until all we had left was the body for examination. She was starting to turn green and red and develop marbling changes, and there was starting to be a strong odor to the body, which also indicates the passage of time of at least a day or two.
She went on to describe how Imani was essentially skin and bones. She had only weighed 32 pounds. Dr. Stauffenberg told the courtroom that Imani had died from starvation and her manner of death was homicide. While she couldn't give an exact time scale, she said that it would have been prolonged and would have been extremely painful.
Well, she was extremely thin and emaciated. She had a starved look, and based on her weight and loss of muscle mass and the fact that her organs were so small compared to the normal charts, I was able to conclude from that she had died from starvation. Well, the first thing that would happen in the early stages, they would experience hunger pangs. She would probably feel hungry. She would be asking for food, looking for food, craving food. Following that, the next step would be apathy, fatigue, not able to do her usual activities. And from there, she would become more and more listless, eventually lethargic, and mental status changes. She would not feel like moving around much. She wouldn't have much energy. There would be extreme weight loss that would be visible. And then finally, death.
Afterwards, the state rested its case. In a regular trial, it would now be the defense's turn to present their case. However, Tiffany announced that she would not be presenting a defense. During closing arguments, Assistant District Attorney Lisa Jones said,
"That child laid in that bed in that room for, depending on whichever day, for at least 5 to 7 more days. Unable to move, burned on her stomach, not eating, not being fed, not being cared for. And she laid in that room alone. While this defendant went about her life, while this defendant goes out for her sister's birthday, talking about in these text messages, what are we going to wear? What shoes? What outfit? We're going to get dressed up. It's your birthday. Happy birthday. Let's get all dolled up and let's take pictures and send them to each other because it's happy. But I have a child in the next room who is near death. But I can just live my life like everything. I will take care of my other children. I will make sure they are fine. But that one, that's his. She's not mine. She's not my problem. But I will dress up and I will go have fun. And then what happens? October 29th comes around. October 29th comes along, and what happens? Imani finally passes. She dies in that room. And why do we know it's October 29th? Because Iman tells you that she called. He wasn't sure it was the 29th or 30th. But then he goes on to tell you that it was the Tuesday before Halloween. The Tuesday before Halloween in 2013 is the 29th. The call logs that seem like maybe why are we doing this, the call logs show you that there were only incoming calls from Tiffany on October 29th. There were none on October 30th to Iman's phone. And it goes with the timeline of when he says he found out she died. She died on October 29th, alone in that bed, in her own filth and in her own waste, while her little brother ran around outside playing, her little sister in the pack and play. And when you match up the pictures from the phone, while this defendant sat watching TV and cooking lasagna, Imani died alone in a room while all that life was going on around her.
According to D.A. Jones, Tiffany hated Imani because the abuse conviction had made her lose her career as a teacher.
She was why she went to jail. It was why she was on probation. It was Imani's fault she was beaten because she didn't do her homework fast enough. This defendant lived with the person in the next room who she despised, who she did not want, who she wanted to be rid of. To this defendant, every single day, that child represented that to her. She was that. Imani was nothing. She was a nuisance. She was ugly. She was nothing. She was a pain. She was disposable. She was trash. She was trash. But she wasn't. She wasn't. She was a child. And she was a granddaughter. And she was a niece. And she was a friend who to kids who needed one. And she was a student who brought joy to a teacher. She was a daughter. She was Imani. She was Imani. And she mattered. She mattered.
Tiffany went through the entire trial without presenting any form of defense. After less than 3 hours of deliberation, the jury reached a verdict. They found Tiffany Moss guilty of the murder of Imani Moss. Now, the trial entered the sentencing phase, where a jury would decide whether Tiffany should die for her crime or be sentenced to life in prison.
Verdict as to penalty, count one, murder. We, the jury, recommend and fix the penalty as death, signed and dated by the foreperson.
Tiffany was subsequently sentenced to death, making her the only woman on George's death row.
I said, Imani, we're almost done. We're almost there. We got another set to go through, and then we'll be home free, and you can rest in peace. Just wanted her to rest, and, you know, she deserved to rest after 5 years, just to rest. When I'm out there, I think about her smile. Sometimes I think about when she had my camera and she was videoing me while I was driving and acting silly. I think about those things. I think about her and the strawberry patch. She loves strawberries and the silly stuff she do, because I think we have one with her and the strawberry in her mouth and she's like, so she loves strawberries. So everything, I think about how she talked to my daughter. I think about how she called my son and how she talks to me. I think about all those things. You know, I'm Grammy. I just want people to wake up and look around and notice that our kids are lacking the love that they're supposed to have. It's too many kids and too many kids raising kids. And the kids are not getting what they need. They need attention. They need love. You have kids that's bullying children for no reason. Why? Because they're not getting the love that they're supposed to have. They might be getting bullied at home. I just want us all to wake up to save our children. It's time.
According to the child advocacy group, Child Help, there are more than 3 million reports of child abuse each year in the United States alone, with between 4 and 7 children dying each day because of abuse and neglect. That number is absolutely shameful, especially in a first world country that prides itself on being a civilized society. The child welfare system truly failed Imani Moss, and her tragic and preventable death became a public symbol for the failings of Georgia's child protection system. While Imani herself could not be saved, her death mobilized child advocates and lawmakers into proposing changes in the system, in the hopes that no other child should have to suffer the same fate that she did. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to say a huge thank you to my new Patreon supporter, Maddie Dilly. I am eternally grateful for the support, and it seriously helps this one-woman podcast. If you'd like to support the show in return for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, early release episodes, ad-free episodes, and other goodies, then please check Morbidology out on Patreon or Himalaya Plus. I'm currently in the process of producing the next exclusive episode, so feel free to check that out. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider leaving me a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening. Ratings and reviews are an easy way to support a podcast, and they truly help out. Big thank you to everybody who has simply listened to an episode. I really appreciate all of the support. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Brew Crime. Until next time, take care of yourself, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
This is Brew Crime, a craft beer and true crime podcast.
I'm Mike.
I'm Beck.
And I'm Nina.
And we're your hosts.
We pair a true crime story with a craft beer.
That Nina will probably hate.
Yeah, probably.
Whatever. You can find our show on all your favorite podcast apps, and if you can't find it, contact us, and we'll try and change that.
We can be found at brewcrime.com or on all social media platforms at brewcrime.
Join us as we discuss the horrible crimes that surround us and try not to giggle.